This is the NBC Theater. From the NBC Theater in Hollywood, an hour-length drama based on William Faulkner's powerful novel, The Wild Palm, a love story darkly told, but with great beauty, by one of America's finest writers. The Wild Palms is one of the few William Faulkner novels which departs the time and place of the main body of his work. But it is very good Faulkner indeed, containing some of his most brilliant and terrifying passages. A story of two lovers, doomed as inevitably and almost as poetically as Romeo and Juliet. Today's adaptation for radio is by Richard E. Davis of NBC. Here now, The Wild Palms by William Faulkner.
The Mississippi sky was overcast. The dark sea wind blew strong and steady and filled the air with the dry, harsh clashing of palm fronds. The wind hissed through the shack, which, weathered and warped by the damp, salt air, leaked all privacy in the manner of broken socks and trousers. On the beach, before the shack, there was a new beach chair where the woman sat, dark-haired, doing nothing, in a pair of faded jean pants and canvas shoes, with queer, hard, yellow eyes in a face whose skin was drawn thin, at first sullen, and later afraid. Not reading, not doing anything, just sitting there, while the man, who was young, too, and dressed in a pair of khaki slacks and a sleeveless jersey undershirt, sat beside her.
What time is it, Harry?
Almost supper time.
It seems later. The sky has turned so dark.
You'd better go in now, dear. You'll be cold.
No. No, I think I'll sit out here a while longer.
You should go in, Charlotte.
I can't. I can't move. I'm hurting.
You've got to hurt, darling. It's the pain that you've got to hold on to keep alive.
To suffer. To live. They're equal. Oh, Harry, I don't want them to be equal.
Hang on to the pain and you'll be all right. Don't let it wash you away.
Wash me away. Oh, listen to the ocean. Cold. It could wash it all away.
Don't talk that way. Don't empty everything out of yourself.
Oh, listen. Let's not kid ourselves. I've had my day of defiance and now I've got to pay up. I'm only holding on so that you can get out of here before they come.
No, no, Charlotte, it's still us.
There is no more us, Harry. Pretty soon the hurt is going to get too big. That's when I won't be able to hold on. And there's just going to be you.
I'll get a doctor.
No. Get away from here and stay away, you promised me.
Let me get a doctor. The landlord in the next shack, he's a doctor. He'll know what to do.
He'll know that there's been an illegal operation, Harry. Oh, he'll know that you're to blame.
He looks like a kind man. I noticed that when he brought over the gumbo that his wife made for
him. Small town doctor with a good busybody wife.
Don't.
Harry.
Don't faint, Charlotte. Don't faint. You've got to hold on.
More gumbo, Doctor?
Why, thank you, Martha. Don't mind if I do. I do declare you make the best gumbo in Mississippi. I hope our tenants next door appreciate what you sent over to them.
The way they're living beats me. Doctor, there's nothing in that house but a bed and a stove.
Oh, they brought that beach chair with them.
The way she sits there, wearing those man's pants, just
well, they pay their rent on time.
She must be sick.
Maybe, Martha. Maybe she is.
He does the woman's work. I saw him trying to clean a mess of fish on the kitchen steps. She was making a mess of it, all right.
Well, maybe she does the cooking.
Where? How? Sitting out there on the beach? What do you think makes her sit like that all day?
I think she's been hurt. Deep. Never in my life have I seen so much hate for the race of man in a woman's eyes.
Then what'd she come down here with him for if she hates him?
Well, she don't hate him. She hates the race of man. The masculine.
I thought you said she didn't talk.
Oh, she didn't talk with me. But I see the way she's listening. She's listening the way people do when they listen to an organ die deep inside themselves. They listen to the beat, the flag maybe, go up and down and up and down, and then finally die.
Open up.
That sounds like a bell in the shack. I told you she was
hurt. More likely she's
coming. I'm coming. I don't know what's been going on over there, but something tells me they ain't going to be pretty.
Now, you hold her head. Can you do that?
Yes, I can do that. All of a sudden, she got worse.
Well, that'll happen with this kind of case. I'll see if this ammonia will help. That's a girl. I think we can keep her alive till the ambulance gets here.
Do you think she'll live?
Well, does she want to live?
I don't know.
Well, you're her husband, aren't you?
Not the way you mean.
But you told me when you rented this place that you were Mr. and Mrs. Who is this woman, anyway?
Mrs. Charlotte Rittenmeyer.
And who does that make you?
Harry Wilburn is my name. Dr. Wilburn.
You? A doctor? Then, are you the man who treated this woman?
Yes. Yes, I did it. I did it.
But what you did was illegal. Against the law of man and God.
I know it, I know. But she didn't want the baby.
Well, just don't try to leave here. You're going to have a lot of explaining to do when the ambulance gets here. And I'll turn you over to the deputy sheriff. You're going to have a lot of talking to do.
Explaining? How can it be explained, any of it? It all began on the night of my 27th birthday. I had 2 months to go to finish out my internship in a New Orleans hospital. I was lying on my cot, thinking of the years which I had dedicated to poverty.
Dr. George, report to Ward 3. Dr. George, report to Ward 3.
As I lay in my cot, I looked down toward my foreshortened feet, and it seemed to me that I saw there the 27 irrevocable years diminished and foreshortened beyond them in turn, as though my life were to lie passively on my back, as though I floated effortless and without volition upon an unreturning stream. Why was I a doctor? To cure, to heal, to soothe the flesh? Or because my father was a doctor before me? My father, who followed my mother to the grave when I was 2 years old and accounted for my future by leaving me the price of a medical education. Money. Money for an education. Money to eat with. Money to live with. Quarters, dimes, nickels, pennies. My father's money, the money of my older sister, struggling to keep me alive until I could keep myself alive. Oh, it was a grand youth, full of scraping and scrabbling, and empty of the charms that belong to the young years. Of girls there were none, of laughter none. But there were books, and books. And now this. I seemed to see the empty years in which my youth had vanished. The years for wild oats and daring, for the passionate ephemeral loves of adolescence which had not been for me. This I was thinking with that peace with which a middle-aged eunuch might look back upon the dead time before his alteration, at the fading and edgeless shapes which now inhabited only memory.
Hiya, Harry.
Oh, hello, Flint.
This telegram came for you down at the desk. Here.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's from my sister.
Huh?
Yes, she wishes me a happy birthday.
The same from me, Harry. You celebrating tonight?
No. I think I'll stay in.
No date again? Not even on your birthday? What's the matter? Don't you believe in fun, Harry?
Well, to tell the truth, Flint, I've been so darn busy I don't know anybody. A girl, that is. I could call up for a date.
Then why not come along with me? I'm going to a party. A real party down in Frenchtown.
No, that's nice of you, Flint, but nobody invited me.
Oh, it's not that kind of a party. All there'll be is a mob sitting around on the floor drinking homemade gin.
Well, I've got no dress clothes.
Your host will probably be wearing a bathrobe. But if you want a tux, I'll borrow you one. We'll be the two fanciest dames at the whole darn party.
All right. Why not, Flint? Why not? Is this the place?
Yeah, this is it, all right. Listen to him, will you? I'll ring the bell.
Oh, I hope this suit looks okay. I've never wore one before.
Harry, sometimes you sound like you've never even been to a party before.
To tell the truth, Flint, this is the first time in all my 27 years I ever was at a real party.
Well, I'll be.
What do I do?
Just find yourself a woman and leave the rest up to her. There's so many things that come natural to a woman that a man just
but
has to learn.
But that's just it. I've never learned anything except, you know, medical books. What do I do?
Well, first thing, you go over and stand in front of one of the pictures. Somebody will come along with an idea, and that's all you have to do. Here we go, Harry.
Harold, where's the pal? It's my old shirt.
Hey, wait a while. This here is Dr. Wilburn, boys and girls. Watch him. He's got a pad of blank checks in his pocket and a scalpel in his sleeve.
Well, if that's true, Dr. Wilburn, I'd like to have a consultation with you. Private.
Come along, Viola. The doctor's too young for you.
Oh, I like that.
Flint, what do I do?
The pictures, like I said. One picture worth 1,000 words. Good luck, kid.
Having trouble making up your mind about that picture, Dr. Wilburn?
I beg your pardon?
That picture you've been staring at. How do you like it?
She was standing beside me. She wasn't beautiful at first glance. She was a young woman and a good deal shorter than I, and for a moment, I thought she was fat. Until I saw it was not fat at all, but merely the broad, simple, profoundly delicate and feminine articulation of Arabian mares. A woman under 25 in a print cotton dress. A face which laid no claim to even prettiness, and wore no makeup save the painted broad mouth, with a faint inch-long scar on one cheek, which I recognized as an old burn, doubtless from childhood.
Having trouble making up your mind about that picture, Dr. Wilburn?
Well, it's a very unusual picture, Miss...
Charlotte's my name. Charlotte Rittenmeyer.
It's a pleasure, ma'am.
Thank you.
What do you think of the picture?
Marshmallows with horseradish. No, I paint too, though I prefer the sculpt.
Oh, a lady artist.
An artist anyway. I can beat that thing hanging there. Feel here, my palm. It's a sculptor's palm.
It's strong. Like a man's.
That's because I work a lot in clay and brass too.
That sounds very interesting. What do you make?
Oh, I make things you can touch, pick up. Something with weight in your hand. Not poking at a piece of cloth with a knife or a brush like you were trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle with a rotten switch through the bars of a cage.
You talk like a man, too.
Well, I'm not. But I know a lot about men.
Oh, you sound very sure when you say that.
That's because all of my family were brothers except me. I like my oldest brother best. But you can't marry your brother, and he and Rittenmeyer roomed together in school, and so I married Rittenmeyer, and now I've got two little girls.
Oh, I didn't know you were...
That I was married.
Uh-huh.
Would it have made any difference?
Well, no, I guess not. I was just hoping that you weren't, that's all.
You aren't married.
Oh, golly, no.
Well, that's something to be thankful for. Not that I'd care either.
What? What's your husband like?
Ooh. His nickname is Rat. What's really important to him is that everybody calls him Rat. Rat's the nickname they give freshmen at the University of Alabama. That's his school. And my husband is the senior living ex-freshman of the University of Alabama. By the way, are you Sonny?
I don't know what you mean.
That dress suit.
Oh. Well, you see, this is my birthday.
Oh.
And it's the first time I ever had a dress suit on.
Well, happy birthday, Harry.
Thanks. I'm 27 years old.
I'll drink to that. Have you had a drink before?
Oh, I know all about alcohol. The technical side, I've performed experiments with mice.
So you know how it is with mice, but you don't know how it is with yourself.
I guess that's about the size of it with a lot of things for me. Most of my life has been spent in books reading other people's answers.
Well, good morning, Dr. Wilburn.
Oh, hello, Flint. Oh, it was a good party.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back among the living. Come 4 a.m., I was getting worried about you.
Oh, I got along all right.
Yeah, I can see that. Wipe the lipstick off your nose.
Hmm?
Where'd you two get to, anyway?
Oh, we went out in the garden. There was a big jasmine bush out there.
Oh, we went out in the garden. She's got a husband, Jack.
I know that.
And kids.
She told me all about that.
She tell you what happens to country boys who get mixed up with married women with husbands and a couple of kids?
I know what you're thinking, Flint. But she's different.
Mm-hmm, yeah, they're all different. That's why it's so much fun. Sounds to me like you got it bad.
Maybe I have, Flint. Maybe I have. I'm going to see her again today for lunch.
Uh-oh.
Twenty-seven years I had gone without love. And then there was this. For the next few weeks, we went for lunch in one of those little French cafes in the Beau Carré in New Orleans, where we could eat on the $2 I was supposed to send each week to my sister back home in Oklahoma.
Harry.
Hmm?
What are we going to do about this?
What can we do?
Oh, don't let's kid ourselves. For weeks we've known that sooner or later we were going to have to figure out what we were going to do.
I don't know, Charlotte. I was never in love before.
I have been. Oh, but I don't know either. I told Rat.
Told him?
About these lunches and about how I've been meeting you.
I suppose he was angry.
No, he did say no divorce. He means it. I even offered him grounds.
Oh, Charlotte, you shouldn't.
Well, what else could I do? Oh, wouldn't it have been worth it? He said no soap.
If he had, what would it have done to your children?
I wasn't thinking of them. I mean, I've already thought of them. So now I don't need to think of them anymore because I know the answer to that. I know I can't change that answer. And I don't think I can change me because the second time I ever saw you, I learned what I had read in books, but I had never actually believed that love and suffering are the same thing, and that the value of love is the sum of what you have to pay for it, and any time you get it cheap, then you've cheated yourself. So I don't need to think about the children. I settled that a long time ago. I was thinking about money.
Oh, Charlotte, I haven't got a cent. If I did, we could go off to Chicago. For 2 years, ever since I came to the hospital, every week for 2 years, I've been sending my sister a money order for $2 and no cents. And to do this, I can't even buy cigarettes.
So, that's that. All of it, huh? The end of us.
Oh, I don't know. I'll figure out something.
Listen, Harry. Tell me again that you haven't got any money.
Huh? Say it.
Give me something that I can accept as the strong reason that we can't meet. Even if I can't believe it or understand that it could be just that. Just money and not anything but just money. Come on, say it.
I have no money.
All right. It makes sense. It makes sense. It must make sense. It'll have to make sense. And now you can take me home. No. No, put me in a cab and send me home on my own money. You pauper.
The cab went on fast. It disappeared almost at once. although I was not looking after it. The opposite direction was mine. I started walking along the curb, and after a while, I came to a trash bin sitting on the curb edge. And there, resting in the mass of discarded newspapers and fruit skins, was a leather wallet. It held five stubs of five pari-mutuel tickets from Washington Park, a customer's identification card from a National Gasoline Trust, and another from a BPOE lodge in Longview, Texas, and $1,278 in bills. $1,278! And the next day we left for Chicago. Rat came to the train with Charlotte. And there they were, the husband and the wife. He in a conservative, unassertive dark suit, the face of a college senior revealing nothing, lending an air of impeccable and formal rightness to the paradoxical act of handing the wife to the lover, almost identical with the mumbo-jumbo of father and bride at a wedding in a church. She stood beside him, watching the train slide in with that instinctive proficiency in and rapport for mating, even of innocent and unpracticed women. That serene confidence in their amorous destinies, like that of birds on their wings, and utter and complete faith in airy and fragile and untried wings. The airy and fragile symbols of love, which in taking flight they repudiate. The three of us stood at the door of the coach.
Harry, Rat's coming with us as far as Hammond.
Go in the coach, Charlotte. Go in and sit down there.
You don't have to push me, Rat.
Remember now, Charlotte, if I don't hear from you by the 10th of each month, I'm going to give the detective the word.
Yes.
And no lies, see? No lies.
Nothing to lie about, Rat.
I want to talk to you, Wilbon. We can stay right here on the platform.
Goodbye, Rat. I'll be in this coach, Harry.
Listen, Wilbon, if any harm comes to her, if you're not on the square with her, I'll know it. If I don't hear from her by the 10th of every month, I'm going to give the detective the word to go ahead. Send him out to Chicago. And I'll know lies, too. See?
I see.
She wouldn't take any money, so here.
What's this?
A cashier's check for $300, payable to the Pullman Company of America. And endorsed, as you'll notice, for one railroad ticket to New Orleans, Louisiana.
I was going to do that with some of my money.
Well, if it's ever cashed and returned to the bank and no ticket bought with it, I'll have you arrested for fraud.
You mean you want her to come back? You'll take her back?
What? I ought to sock you.
It seemed at that moment that Rat and I both stood aligned, embattled, doomed, and lost before the entire female principle. I took the check and went to sit beside Charlotte in the coach.
Where are we now, Harry?
On our way to Chicago, north.
I mean the place this minute.
Oh, on a trestle on the water, away out beyond Murray Pass and Pontchartrain. Oh, a lot of water. All swamp-bound and no horizon in sight.
I love water. That's where to die. That's where I'd like to die, in the water. Not in the hot air above the hot ground. To wait hours for your blood to get cool enough to let you sleep. And even weeks for your hair to stop growing. The water. To cool you quick so that you can sleep. To wash out of your brain and out of your eyes and out of your blood all that you ever saw and thought and felt and denied.
Let's look ahead, darling, to the new life that we both believed in. Now is the honeymoon.
Listen, Harry, it's got to be all honeymoon. Always, forever and ever until one of us dies. It can't be anything else, either heaven or hell. No comfortable, safe purgatory between for you and me to wait until good behavior or shame or repentance overtakes us.
So it's not me you believe in, but trust in. It's love, not just me. Any man and love.
Yes, it's love. They say love dies between two people, but that's wrong. It doesn't die. It
just leaves you. It goes away if you aren't good enough or if you aren't worthy enough. It doesn't die. You're the one who dies.
I've got to get used to love, Charlotte. You've got to give me time. I've never tried it before. You see, I'm 10 years behind myself.
You're getting used to it. You stole the money we've got now. Wouldn't you do it again? Isn't what we've got now worth it, even if the rest of our lives go bust and we have to spend the rest of our lives paying interest?
Yes. Yes, only it's not going to bust tomorrow, nor next month, nor next year.
Nor ever. Oh, not as long as we're worthy of keeping it. Oh, good enough and strong enough. Worthy enough to be allowed to keep it. Keep it, Harry. That's what we're going to do. And that's not sin. It can't be sin.
From Hollywood, the NBC Theater is bringing you Wally Mayer as Harry and Lynn Allen as Charlotte in a dramatization of William Faulkner's somber novel, The Wild Palms. We will resume with Act Two after a brief pause for station identification.
When we got to Chicago, Charlotte took over the problem of finding us an apartment. I don't know what it is about women that makes them so efficient in the domiciling of an affair. Not thrift, not husbandry, but something far beyond that. A completely infallible instinct. A completely uncerebrated rapport, and they all believe they can take Lothario himself and trim the very incorrigible bachelor's ringlets, which snared them into the seemly decorum of Monday's hash and suburban trains.
Harry! Harry, I found it!
Found what?
An apartment. A studio apartment where I can work, too.
Wait a minute. What is this work, too?
Well, Harry, you don't think that $1,200 will last forever.
Well, we seem to be doing pretty good.
Mm-hmm. There's always a day of reckoning. And for us, that day comes on the 15th of September. And on that day, we won't have any money left.
Then it began. The endless, fruitless tramping of the streets. The looking for a job, the jostlings of the crowd. And the lost, empty faces. The hospitals, the interviews by residents and staff heads. The sterile, antiseptic waiting rooms. Yes, sir. Oh, yes, sir. I served 20 months internship. Here's my diploma, sir. The shaking faces. White faces moving from side to side over white jackets. And the street again. I wasn't qualified to practice medicine in Chicago.
Harry, look at me.
Oh, what's the use? There's not a hospital in Chicago that'll have me.
I'll have you.
Me, the great provider, the iridescent man in white.
The trouble with you, Harry, is that you don't have the slightest understanding of the word love.
The trouble with me is I'm 10 years behind myself. Oh, but you just wait till I get used to love.
I'll give you a lifetime.
Just a while. Just a little while. Then I'll think of something. I'll be all right.
You think a lot, don't you, Harry?
I do. And the fact is... Now, please don't laugh at this. But I was thinking that as long as I can't practice medicine here in Chicago, I might try to do a little writing about some of the things I've been thinking about.
Harry, that's wonderful.
Oh, not that I take it seriously, you understand, but I thought... Well, you know, they say write about something you know about. So I thought I'd write about love. That was the beginning of our life in Chicago. I rented a typewriter and began writing fiction, confession stuff, and I sold it. Charlotte began to make little figures, which she sold to stores for window displays. Money came in little by little, and we squeaked by the 15th of September that Charlotte had worried about. At the first, we had each other. But then Charlotte got a job decorating in one of the Chicago stores, days, which left me all alone, days. And then the Christmas season started. Charlotte began to work nights, evenings, that is. And then something happened one night just 2 days before Christmas.
Just a minute. I'm coming.
Harry, help me, will you? My arms are full of packages. I can't reach my cage.
Here, I'll take some of those.
Thank you.
Well, you're home early tonight.
Yes. I simply had to take some time off to do my Christmas shop. I wondered how long I'd have to wait for a spot of necking. How'd your day go?
Oh, I cranked out 3,000 words from 8 o'clock till sundown. Yes, sir. A true epic of confession fiction beginning, at 16, I was a mother and a widow.
It sounds great. Oh, it's too bad the publisher won't get in time to send a check back before Christmas.
Well, when your job gives out after the holidays, we'll need every nickel we can get our hands on.
But that's it. I've good news, Harry.
Hmm?
They've offered to keep me on at the store after Christmas, clear through the summer at least. Oh, isn't it wonderful?
Oh, Charlotte, you shouldn't be working like this. Now, I don't mean to come a heavy husband on you, but it's wrong.
Why, for heaven's sake?
Because we're never alone anymore.
Why, you home-wrecking Boy Scout, you. Why, we've always been alone. No two people could be more alone if they tried.
That's not true, Charlotte. Why, with these crazy hours, we never see each other.
But we will. Well, honestly, I never in my life saw anybody try as hard to be a husband as you do.
But all we do is sleep and eat.
But that's all other people do.
But never together, never alone together. And that's what we bought when we walked out of New Orleans. That's what we're paying for, to be together and together, and that's what must be.
Of course, Harry, that's what we want for us. Well, I'll tell them to take their old job and give it to somebody else. Somebody who has a husband who doesn't love them as much as mine.
Oh, she was a better man than I was. She loved that job. But most of all, she wanted for us to be happy. So she quit the job. And 3 weeks later, I entered a downtown Chicago office building and ascended 20 floors to an opaque glass door lettered Callahan Mines. And there I met a red-faced, cold-eyed man of 50. A deck of playing cards lay on the desk before him, arranged for solitaire.
Can I help you?
Well, I'm looking for the office of the Callahan Mines.
This is it. Wait a minute. Guess that's as far as I can go. I'm Callahan.
Oh, well, my name is Harry Wilburn, Dr. Harry Wilburn.
Oh, you come about the ad?
Yes, sir. You advertise for a doctor at your Utah mine.
You want the job?
Yes, Mr. Callahan, and I think I can meet the qualifications. I went 4 years to medical school and graduated...
Never mind all that.
But I'm just trying to tell you,
sir. Doesn't matter. Can you take care of the ordinary injuries that happen to men working in a mine shaft?
Oh, yes, of course.
All right. That's only part of the job, taking care of the men.
I don't think I understand.
The other part is taking care of the mine, the people who own it, who'll be paying your salary. I don't care two hoots how much or how little surgery and pharmacology you know or how many degrees you got. I want to know if you can be depended on to protect the mine, the company, against lawsuits. We don't want any backfires. Can you take care of that?
Yes, sir.
All right. There'll be no medical inspectors out there to have to see your license. Remember, the company first.
I remember.
If you want the job, you leave Chicago tomorrow. The pay is $1,500 in keep.
What? Well, that's not much, Mr. Callahan. I've got a
good... Then you don't want this job. This job is nowhere near up to your qualifications and your deserts. Good day. I said good morning.
If you'll give me transportation for my wife, I'll take the job.
You're on, Wilburn. There's a train leaves Chicago for Utah tomorrow night. Be on it.
So we made ready to leave the apartment in Chicago, where we had lived all of those months, and in our leaving left no other mark of all of our time of living and loving, other than cigarette scars on the table. No mark of the worthwhile believing in relationship that we were trying to build. And when the time came to go, a friend came by for us. McCord, a young fellow who knew one of Charlotte's brothers in New Orleans. McCord was one of those pleasant young men called good guys. Charlotte and I liked him very much. He came by in his car and drove us down to the station.
Train number 4, the Mountaineer, leaving from the west on track 17 in 10 minutes.
Well, you two, still time to back out.
McCord, we're not to be tempted by last-minute speeches.
Well, before you folks give yourself up to the winter in Utah, we have time for one drink.
Well, you and Harry have one, Mac. I'm no good at farewells.
Charlotte, could I have a kiss from you before you go?
For sure, Mac. I'll make it one for the road. Only I'm the one that's going down the road. Goodbye, Mac.
Keep punching, kid.
I'll be along in a couple of minutes, Charlotte. Well, she took that pretty seriously.
Oh, I'm sorry, Harry.
I didn't mean that. I just wondered what it was with you.
Well, it was for a second there I knew I'd never see you again. Oh, how about that drink?
What'll it be, gentlemen?
Ryan water, please.
Same for me.
Very well, sir.
Well, what's eating at you, Mac?
Well, I wish I knew what it's all about. You're leaving Chicago this way.
So do I.
Here, you're making fair money, and Charlotte has a good job. You had a nice place to live in, and then all of a sudden you quit it. Make Charlotte throw up her job and start out in February to live in a mine shaft in Utah.
Listen, Mac. Charlotte taught me a long time ago that the best thing in life was to live for the short time you're alone. Breathe, be alive, and know it.
So why go all the way to Utah to breathe? What's wrong with Chicago?
We're getting respectable, and we don't like what it's doing to us. It's respectability that makes chiropractors and clerks, bill posters and motormen and pulp writers of us all.
But you were doing all right, Harry.
Mac, I had tied myself hand and foot in a little strip of ink ribbon. Daily, I watched myself getting more and more tangled in it like a roach in a spider web. And all the while, I thought we were going great guns.
What changed your mind?
I got afraid.
You had love and money. What was there to be afraid of?
Because money you can't depend on. And there's no place in the world for love today. Mankind has eliminated it. Oh, it took us a long time, but man is limitless and resourceful in inventing too. And so we've got rid of love at last. Why, if Jesus returned today, we would have to crucify him quick in our own defense. To justify and preserve the civilization, we have worked and suffered and died, shrieking in rage and impotence and terror for 2,000 years to create and perfect in man's own image.
So, if you know that's true in Chicago, it's true in a forsaken mine shaft.
The city is just part of what was being done to us. Living the way we had to, starving would have been nothing. It could have done nothing but kill us. What we had, Mac, was worse than death or division even. It was the mausoleum of love. And we chose to get out.
But out of the frying pan, Harry. Oh, what next?
So let the next move be up to them. I'm vulnerable and neither money nor respectability now. And so they'll have to find something else to force us to conform to the pattern of human life, which has now evolved to do without love, to conform or die. So I'm afraid, Mac, because they're smart or shrewd, or they'll have to be. Why, if they were to let us beat them, it would be like unchecked murder and robbery.
Well, then you can't beat them.
Of course we can't beat them. We're doomed. That's why I'm afraid.
Train number 4, the Mountaineer, leaving for the west in 5 minutes.
Will you give me your blessing?
You can take my curse.
A great dirty canyon served as a bed for the mine shaft. On one wall, a half dozen houses made mostly of sheet iron and window deep in snow clung. The canyon was not wide. It was a ditch, a gutter. It soared, swooping the pristine snow, scarred and blemished by, and dwarfing the shaft entrance, the refuse dump, the few buildings. Beyond the canyon rims, the actual unassailable peaks rose. Cloud raveled in some incredible wind on the dirty sky. And the whole had a quietness that was strange.
The Callahan mines. They look deserted, Harry.
Maybe that's the way mines look, blank and ugly.
It'll be beautiful in the spring.
It better be.
Let's go somewhere. I think I'm going to freeze.
Well, let's try that shack, I guess. Hmm?
No. You know, funny, the superintendent didn't come down to meet us.
Superintendents always act funny. That's why they're superintendents.
Maybe he lives in the mine and only comes up on weekends.
Well, he's supposed to have a wife.
Come in.
Are you the superintendent?
That's right. You mind closing the door?
No.
What can I do for you, mister?
I'm Dr. Wilburn, and this is my wife, Charlotte.
Pleased to know you. This is Mrs. Buckner.
How'd you do? Hello.
I'm Bill Buckner.
Well, I'm glad to see you, sir.
You and the missus picked a bad day to travel, didn't you?
Well, Mr. Callahan said he'd get out here right away.
Callahan? You mean he sent you out here?
That's right, sir. He hired me in Chicago.
Well, I'll be... sent you out here. Did you hear that, Billy?
What's so funny? It isn't a doctor we need.
Well, I don't understand this. Callahan said you needed a doctor because you had a lot of Chinese workmen.
The Chinese are gone.
And Italian workmen.
Gone, every last one of them. All we got are Poles working night and day to make overtime they're never going to get.
Well, I don't understand.
Tell him, Buck. Don't keep him in suspense.
Well, yes, come on and tell us.
There hasn't been a payroll in here since last September.
What?
Callahan mines are broke. Maybe he can hustle up some money now that you're here. I don't know. Looks to me like the only reason Callahan hired you was to meet examinations by the mine inspectors. Then he can keep his mine open and still go on selling stock back in Chicago.
Reach over and turn up the stove, will you, Harry?
Oh, yes, sure, darling. I must have dozed off. What happened to our friends, the Buckners?
They went on up to bed. Harry, what are we going to do? We can't stay here.
It looks like the question is, when do we get out?
It's got to be soon, Harry.
Well, we can stick it out until we get our bearings and then shove off again after a couple of months.
It's got to be sooner than that, Harry.
Hmm? What do you mean?
Oh, Harry, put your arms around me and hold me.
What happened?
Leave me, Harry. I'd give anything if it only hadn't happened, but now it has.
Darling, what are you trying to say?
There's a baby on the way.
Charlotte.
I didn't mean for it to happen.
When will it be?
In the summer. Oh, but it can't be, Harry. I don't want it.
Of course we want
it. No! No! We choose our lives and the way we live. There can never be any children.
But it'll still be you and I, Charlotte. A baby can't change us.
We don't know, Harry. We can't be sure of that. I don't want it, and you've got to do something about it.
What are you getting at? What are you suggesting?
Call it what you like. But you're a doctor, Harry, and there must be something that
you can... Now, listen. Listen, don't ever think about that. There are some things a doctor...
Don't be a Boy Scout on me now, Harry.
Oh, now, listen to me, Charlotte. Oh, listen, darling, you're upset now. All women are. But they get used to the idea.
Oh, no, I don't want to get used to the idea. And that's why you've got to do something about it.
What you're suggesting is murder.
No, it's different. You're a doctor.
No decent doctor in his right mind would listen to what you're suggesting. Oh, look, darling, look, we'll go where it's warm. Down south, you can have the baby.
I've already had two. I don't want this one.
Don't say that.
Children hurt too much, Harry. Not in the being born, but in the living. Oh, you've got to do it, Harry.
And finally I did. Because there seemed nothing else to do. I did what Charlotte asked in the name of our love. But something went wrong. In the great doom black tent in which we crawled. Two people in search of happiness. Something went wrong. I kept my promise to Charlotte and took the life she asked. And in the taking, I marked the one I loved to follow the unlamented, unborn. I grew weaker and weaker. Knowing, half-guessing, she asked me to take her back to New Orleans so that she might have a chance to say goodbye to Rat and her children. And then we were back in New Orleans where we had started a year before. And once again, Charlotte was standing inside Victor Meyer's house and I was waiting outside. She was seeing her children, the ones she had born. Was it for the last time? And once the children were out of the room, Rat would try to reason with her.
Charlotte, listen to me.
I tell you, I won't go to a hospital.
But if something's gone wrong, you can die. Maybe you've got, what do they call it, toxemia, septicemia? You're sick. Go to a hospital.
I can't go to a hospital, Rat.
Because you're afraid they'll find out what Harry did to you and put him in prison for it?
It wasn't his fault.
I won't let him hurt Harry. I'll assume all the blame, tell all the lies. I want to save you, Charlotte.
Rhett, we're going away. Harry and I are leaving New Orleans.
When?
This afternoon. We're going to a village on the Mississippi coast.
But there are doctors and hospitals here that can help you, Charlotte. Why are you going away?
To sit in the sun until I get better.
But if you don't get better,
then I'll sit in the sun.
Well, Charlotte, we're almost there. The sun will be good for you, darling, or you'll be all right.
Do you love me, Harry? A lot, an awful lot.
You know that I do.
Then listen. If we're going to get it.
Get it?
If I don't live, you'll know in time, won't you?
We're not going to get anything. You'll hold out. I've helped you hold out so far, haven't I?
Don't be a fool now. There's no time. Every minute I get worse. You'll know in time, so get out, you hear?
Don't talk that way.
Promise me. Oh, don't you know what they'll do to you? You can't lie to anybody, even if you would. And you won't be able to help me if you stay. But you'll know in time. Just telephone an ambulance or the police or something and wire Rat and get out fast. Promise.
Charlotte. Oh, doctor.
Take it easy there, young fellow. There's nothing you can do.
I didn't want to do it.
You better keep calm. Things will be getting a lot worse.
No. She can't stand anymore.
I'm talking about you. The deputy will want to talk to you when he comes. You're going to jail.
Let him come, but let him come fast.
Harry!
Oh, where's the ambulance? Doctor, you phoned for the ambulance, didn't you?
It's coming. You ain't in New Orleans now, son. Takes time in these little Mississippi towns. We don't have many emergencies like this one.
Well, why don't they hurry? She's suffering.
You should have thought of that before, son. Before you murdered her.
The siren came. And the ambulance appeared. And the deputy, with the indelible mark of 10,000 southern deputy sheriffs, the snapped hat brim, the sadistic eyes, the slightly unmistakably bulged coat, the air not swaggering exactly, but of a formerly pre-absorbed brutality, who snapped the handcuffs on my wrist and supervised Charlotte's loading into the ambulance by the intern. Who didn't do a thing for her but took her name and age and birthday in triplicate and asked me if instead of going first to the jail, would I like to go to the hospital and wait?
while the doctors tried to save the life of Rittenmeyer's Charlotte.
Dr. Richardson.
Mister, I wonder how long they're going to work on that little old girl of yours in there.
I don't know, officer.
Every smart man in the hospital's been in that operating room almost since the minute they wheeled her in.
You got a cigarette?
I told you, you can't smoke in here.
Oh.
You know, you hear a lot of funny stories about doctors and nurses. You think they're true about what goes on in hospitals?
They're like the stories you hear about every place else.
Hey, now. Look at his sweet little eyes.
Mr. Wilburn.
I'm Mr. Wilburn.
Doctor says I can take you in to see her now, but just for a minute.
You mean in a room?
On the operating table.
Then she didn't live?
Mrs. Rittenmeyer died at 11:03.
Oh.
Come on, Jack.
Take him to the dispensary officer. The doctor says you can give him a drink.
I don't want it.
Better take it, Jack. Because over yonder in our little old jail, you're going to get some mighty thin living.
Oh, I hate to see that evening sun go down. I hate to see that evening sun go down.
Quiet!
Cause my baby...
Quiet, Donna, then!
Visitor to see you, Wilburn.
Send him down, officer.
Right down there, Mr. Rittenmeyer. Well, Wilburn?
How are you, Rat?
I just came from Charlotte's funeral.
Is that what you came to tell me?
I brought your clothes.
I see you have. Thanks.
I've made your bond. They'll let you out this morning.
Oh, hooray.
And I brought you some money. It's the same $300 I gave you in the check when you and she went away the first time.
I don't want it now any more than I wanted it then.
$300 should get you a long way. I'd say Mexico.
What are you getting at, Rat? You want me to jump bail?
Yes. Get away from here. I'll buy you a railroad ticket and send it to you.
I'm sorry.
If you got to New Orleans, you could even ship out on a boat.
I'm sorry.
Think of her.
I wish I could stop. I wish I could. No. No, I don't. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the reason.
Then think about me.
I wish I could stop that, too. I feel like...
Not me. Don't you feel sorry for me? See?
Rat. Maybe I'm sorry because you can't do anything.
You won't go?
Maybe if you could tell me why.
Time's up, Mr. Rittenmeyer.
I'm coming.
You forgot the money.
So you won't do it? You won't?
I'm sorry, Rat. Only if you could just have told me why, maybe I would have.
Maybe he'll understand a lot of things a little better, Mr. Rittenmeyer, when the state of Mississippi gets him into court.
How does the prisoner plead?
Guilty, Your Honor.
Is the accused trying to throw himself on the mercy of the court?
I just plead guilty, Your Honor.
Then there's no need for the state to make a case. I will instruct the jury...
Francis, kill him! Kill him!
Who is that man?
I'm Francis Rittenmeyer, husband of the deceased.
Disarm that man!
I'm not armed!
What's the meaning of this clowning?
If the court please, I'd like to say something.
You got no right.
Order! Order! Mr. Rittenmeyer, this case is closed. However, if you still wish to make a statement, you may do so. Step forward, please.
I would like to make a statement. I wish to make a plea for mercy for this man.
You what? You what, sir?
A plea. I would like to make a plea for mercy.
Mercy for this man who willfully and deliberately sent your wife to her death?
Order! Order! Clear the court! Order!
I'll clear the court. Sit down, Mr. Rittmeyer. I'll get you protection out of town.
I don't want protection.
Maybe you need it. Now, sit down. Gentlemen of the jury, you will find the prisoner guilty as charged, and so bring in your verdict, which carries with it sentence of hard labor in the state penitentiary for a period of not less than 50 years. You may retire.
I reckon there's no need of that, Judge. I reckon we all pretty much...
You will retire. Do you wish to be held in contempt? Retire, even if you come back in 2 minutes.
Feeling tomorrow just like I feel today. Feeling tomorrow just like I feel today.
The Mississippi wind blew soft and dark through the palms that clashed in the dull of early after sundown dark, bringing with it the smell of swamps and wild jasmine, blowing on under the dying west and the bright star. It was night.
Hello, Wilbur.
All right. I didn't see you standing there.
The deputy let me in. I brought you something.
Money?
No, a package. A little package. Here, take it.
Rat, you just won't give up, will you? What is this stuff, cyanide?
50 years is a long time.
I won't use it, Rat. But I thank you. I thank you, Rat.
I'm not doing it for you. I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for her!
And so, it is for this that I am living. But while I am, there is memory to think about. Forever and inescapable. So long as there is flesh to respond to the memory. And if memory exists outside the flesh, it won't be memory, because it won't know what it remembers. So if she became not, then half of memory became not. And if I became not, then all remembering will cease to be. And between grief and nothing, I will take grief.
You have heard The Wild Palms, a dramatization by Richard E. Davis of the William Faulkner novel. Be with us at the NBC Theater next week for a unique presentation of a great farce comedy, The Doctor in Spite of Himself, by Molière, late of France. The following week, we will bring you a first American radio presentation of a work by Jean-Paul Sartre, The Chips Are Down. And, after that, a production of the ever-exciting The Time of Man, by Elizabeth Maddox Roberts. Today's production of The Wild Palms featured Wally Mayer as Harry, Lynn Allen as Charlotte. Gayne Whitman was the narrator, Gloria Ann Simpson was Martha, Don Randolph the doctor, Helen Andrews the nurse, William Lally was Flint, Ann Diamond was Viola, Donald Woods was Rat, Nestor Piver was Callahan, Clark Gordon was McCord, Shep Mencken a deputy. Your announcer, Don Stanley. The NBC Theater is produced by Wade Arnold. The director of the NBC Theater is Andrew C. Love. This program came to you from Hollywood. What's on NBC today? The Harvest of Stars and the NBC Summer Symphony both present special broadcasts. Harvest of Stars features a 55-voice chorus with tenor star James Melton. And later, Alfred Wallenstein will conduct the NBC Symphony Orchestra with pianist William Capel as guest soloist. Today, tune here for great music. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.